So if you have some thoughts, Sue, that you'd like to share with me in America, I'd love to hear them.
Yes, well, I think it's an amazing story, really, and not one that was anticipated in any way and came out of the need. As I wrote about in the book, For the Children's Sake, we had our Maggie, who was 11 years old, coming up to the break in English education, and we weren't satisfied with the opportunities, and we started looking for schools. And that's when we found this little school about 15 miles away that was a PNEU school, run by an eccentric, not the best model for all PNEU schools, but it shows how, really shows the flexibility of the basic ideas.
Did you know what PNEU meant when you found this school?
No, we had no idea. We were just looking at everything. Then, having visited, I sent off to London for the Charlotte Mason books because Olive Norton, who ran this little school, had said they were based on those ideas. So the books came, probably towards a philosophy of education. There were certainly two because Ranald, my husband, and I were both reading them, and we were thrilled with what we found as a philosophy of education. A few years before, in 1965, I suppose, we lived in London and we had a non-residential branch of the Brief Fellowship in our home while my husband, Ranald, was studying at the university in studying theology, a second degree,
in London.
In London. Anyway, we had already lived in London about 2-3 years, and we had a small baby by that time, by 1965, and a little girl of about 3 years old at that time. So I had always been interested in education and thought about it. Now, if you know anything about Le Brief Fellowship, we always try to take current issues or problems of life or moral or intellectual questions of thought and apply them to, or try to relate them to, the Christian ideas, infrastructure, truth, biblical ideas. So anyway, at that time, my father, Francis Schaeffer, was coming over with my mother regularly to our home. They were good pioneers because we didn't have any furniture. It was a big old, cold old house. They didn't seem to mind sleeping in an empty bedroom, but Professor Rookmacher from Holland, an art historian who was a friend of my father's, would come, and he did mind our cold house. Well, anyway, we would arrange lectures because our Le Brief work consisted of weekend work. So we would have a Saturday night discussion and Sunday evening also a meal and a Bible study. We had up to 60 students coming, which was a challenge because I did all the cooking and everything. But one of the lectures we wanted was on education. When my dad came, he would lecture on his sort of things. When Professor Rookmacher came, he would lecture on history of art and Christianity. And actually, it was a very seminal time. It has borne fruit through the years, this early 60s work in London. And one of the conferences we did, well, we kept looking for somebody who could give lectures on education from a Christian point of view. We never found any to our satisfaction. This is about 10 years later, when I started telling Maggie, by this time was 11, so yes, maybe a bit less than 10 years. By this time, we had been asked to have a residential Le Brief in a manor house in Hampshire, and another couple had stayed in London to run the work there, which had changed to some extent. So about 10 years later, when Maggie needed a secondary school and we started looking, we still hadn't found a philosophy of education. We had lectures in Le Brief on art and medical ethics and creation and all sorts of things, but never were satisfied with education. So as we were thinking of our own child's needs, we discovered later she was dyslexic, as well as a very bright and artistic little girl. She didn't fit into the academic. The closest thing would be the classical schools in America, but certain ability to find it easy to do all the memorizing and the more routine tasks of academic work, well able to do all the thinking and creative side. But we started reading Charlotte Mason, and we thought, this is it. All this time, this is what we've been looking for.
What was it particularly that you made you feel very excited and sure about it?
Well, it was, we were both really clear and had quite a bit of experience, both of life and community, the needs of a variety of human beings, including children. We knew what we wanted for our own children. I had been brought up, as I wrote about in the book, for the family's sake, quite a bit. There was quite a bit of autobiography in that, and also about Charlotte Mason's early life. And like many other people, like Charlotte Mason, I was brought up to be able to be free and enjoy nature. My father would take me on walks, and we would notice things and really appreciate beauty. Because I was growing up in Europe, there was the art, and they, even though they were almost penniless, they somehow managed to get us to Florence or Milano or Genoa or somewhere each year on the way to our vacation. So we had art starting from the time I was 7. That was in Holland, and I've never forgotten it. And then we read books out loud, and somehow they had brought hundreds of books with them from America. So even though I didn't have a library, there were always books to read, and they read out loud. The elements of Charlotte Mason's education I myself had experienced. So we didn't need a written-out philosophy to recognize the elements which are life-giving and last for the whole of life. And that's what we had already started doing with our own children, quite naturally. It wasn't what we call in England rocket science, all that different. Right through the years, if you read people's autobiographies, you'll find this is the way people were brought up. In England, certainly, a combination of a love of nature, books, and underneath it, this undergirding of an assurance of God and its truth and who we are as persons. And it's not what we achieve necessarily, but it's who we are and the importance of relationships and the little ordinary things, which Charlotte Mason were very important to her. She writes in, I remember, in the one about education up to the age of 9, which is called Home Education, about how a little child is, there was Froebel, was developing kindergartens at that time, and it's good work, but she was saying so much more educational for a little child to have to be quiet because granny's having a nap. And something about real life and responding and being sensitive to other people, which was one of the benefits for our children of growing up in Le Brie, having people up with different needs and being aware that they are hungry, they need things. You do ordinary, everyday activities, and it doesn't close out this richness of life. So we recognized it immediately. It was just what we wanted, but we needed it put into words. And we could latch on to something we already believed in. And I know Charlotte Mason in another place has written, I can't tell you where, that truth is like that, that we recognize truth when we see it. And this is jumping to a totally different thing. Why Elaine and I have just been talking, but one of the appeals to parents today, they don't know what they're looking for. But when they see children enjoying these things, there's something very profound in them that thinks, yes, yes, this is the way it should be. And there have been some television programs in England. I haven't seen them myself, but my son told me about them. He said it reminded him of Le Brie. the Riverside restaurant or something, and anyway, this chap grew vegetables, and then they would sit, and he had a farm, and would eat the food he grew with people of different sorts, laughing and talking, and this sense of warmth and humanity and community. Mm-hmm. Well, there are all those elements. And if you read about Charlotte Mason's life and people's experiences, one of the things that comes through strongly is her humanity and the people she worked with, like Elaine and I knew her as Kitchener, who wrote some wonderful things and worked very closely with Charlotte Mason, and Essex Chumley, who worked very closely with her and lived up there in Ambleside. But the echoes you get back are of having fun when the lake was frozen, ringing the bell and saying, it's much too nice a day to work today, let's go out and enjoy. So this sense of life and being sure of your philosophy and your aims, but also having a freedom and a responsiveness to each other, whether it's age, infirmity, or a child who perhaps learns more slowly than another one. But as Charlotte Mason said, no, they haven't failed. You spread this banquet of life, really, and of ideas, and then they take from it what is right for them. That is what a good family should do. That is actually what a good church community should do.
And Sue, so after this contact with the school and seeing your own children thriving in this little PNAU school, what finally made you decide to write the book?
Yes, well, so the children went, and we decided to send our younger daughter as well, who was 5 at the time. No, she wasn't. She was 7. Anyway, we saw them just picking up and for the first time thriving like plants, as I wrote, really, truly, starting to thrive and have too much to talk about when they came home, things just bumbling over and how they were enjoying this and that book and wanted to know what happened next and enjoying their days. And even though they were long days and we had to drive, they were more refreshed. And I think that's an aspect of all of school. Later on, I had my 6th child there reasonably recently, 1990, I guess, even more recently than that. And I would drive over to get the children, and they didn't want to come home, and that was 5 o'clock in the afternoon because they were sitting. By this time, Olive was quite old, and she was a bit Alzheimer-y, but she still managed to get Abby through her common entrance exams, not by trying to pass exams, just because of what she had offered. And the children would be sewing or painting or doing something in clay, and Olive would sit there, also oblivious to the time, reading to them some Greek tale or something, and they wouldn't want to come home. Mm. And that's very important. They were enjoying their time and they didn't want to leave. That is a quality. It's a quality with people of any age, like people sitting around a meal and they don't want to get up because they're enjoying the conversation and they linger. That lingering. Anyway, so we saw these children thriving. I started, the nature of Le Brie is you talk about things. You talk about them at meal times because that's one of the ways at Le Brie we disseminated information and had discussion and learning, and that goes on today in branches of Le Brie. Incidentally, very like Thomas Jefferson, who built these dining rooms all around the university for the very same purpose, for the tutors to talk with their pupils, students over meals. But anyway, then the next thing was to give lectures, and that was very natural in Le Brie. So I started giving talks to our local people, and eventually I started being invited to coffee mornings around England, basically, and around, and people were interested, and I gave more definitive talks about it and read more and more. And by this time, when I look back to reading those first books, shortly afterwards, I had gone up to London to one of the annual meetings of the PNAU, and somebody had one of the businessmen who was about to destroy the PNAU and just get in a had no respect for the philosophy or interest in it and just treated it as a business. They, sadly, were the board, the governors running it. And he said, I don't see why you're interested in this. You're a young woman. You should be looking to the future of education. Well, I had gone back home. Our interest had grown. This is going back before I started giving talks. And Ranel joined me. He went to an AGM once in London that I didn't go to, somewhere along there. But we, in that first year or two, we ended up in London. We walked in together to the principal who was running the home education side, and it wasn't called home education.
World Education Service.
Yes. Mm. And she was a totally trained Charlotte Mason teacher. Her sister, Elizabeth, was well known in PNEU circles. Was the sort of person that to me epitomizes the fruit of a PNEU life and teaching. A gentlewoman, non-assuming, truly learned in the sense of really not trying to put on having read so many books, but just a literate in a person in a quiet, cultured way, in her blue twin set with her pearls. And we went in and we said, we've been looking for this for years, and we really want to do something about it now. And she got tears in her eyes, and she wasn't that sort of person, and she said, you've come too late. It's all over. She had handpicked somebody to follow her, and this board had said, no, she couldn't. They had taken it out of her hands and said, now, they got somebody who used to come and visit us. He wasn't a bad person, but he had no idea of the difference of PNEU. He was somebody who had been in what Americans would call the public schools, and he was a business sort of administrative person who was all into the 1970s, which were open plan, don't teach children anything structured, do away with phonics sort of thing. And yes, their English education went through a very difficult time when children didn't learn much. They were supposed to express themselves all the time, which with our large classes ended in chaos. 35 children, chaotic. Anyway, he used to come down, but he wasn't really interested. He'd come to Hampshire, where we had Labrie, and talked to us a few times. Ranald went to a couple of AGMs in London. But it was around that time, probably about 1981. So our children had gone through the PNEU school. We had younger children in the school. They probably had gone through. I've done a lot of reading, given many lectures on it in this small way, just to small groups or coffee mornings. And then Ranald said to me one day, you should write a book. You have to write a book. You must write a book about this. So there wasn't any time because I was working in Labrie and I had four children, and we also off and on fostered other children. So we had different experience. So it continued. Folder A.
Yes.
So now where was I?
Writing.
So we had the children had gone through. They were out the other side. Ranald said I should write this book, and I was working. It was a very extremely busy time in my life. So the one time I could write it, you might be interested in, was about three times a week. I had no time to plan it or anything, but I had been especially immersed the previous year in all of her Charlotte Mason's books because I had given a series of lectures, I think. So I had really had been as much, and there's people now who know a lot more than I do, I'll tell you. But, I mean, up to that point, there were clear things in my mind. So I used to sit down when everybody settled. It was about 11 o'clock at night. Because by that time I had teenagers and students and people. And just start writing the different chapters. And it came very easily. I do feel, as a Christian actually, I didn't have time to plan it properly. And I really feel it was given. I think I feel that very strongly. And I felt doing it that it was something which was a light which was to be handed on. I didn't feel it was my own thing, but it was very much my thing. It had synthesized really with my own life and thinking and Labrie and my personal self. and the experience of bringing up children, different kinds of children and people. So it wasn't as if it was it wasn't just a researched piece of work at all. It came out as a living thing. And I think the way people have read it has shown that's what it was. It's like a conversation, a sharing, but a passing on. And it has gone into the public domain. So now if you look on the internet and other places, there have been things published that I would definitely not feel represent Charlotte Mason truly. There will be elements in it and encouragements to people in the right directions. It's very different when you've actually lived close to the source of something, as I well know with people trying to talk about all sorts of things in life. And when you do it secondhand, it starts changing and you lose something. Now, to go back to writing the book, it went off. And first of all, an American editor, there was another publisher that was going to have it. She couldn't understand what I was writing about. And so she rewrote it like a ghostwriter. And when I saw it, I said, well, look, I'd rather not publish this at all. Just finish it. If it's not going to be my book, we won't have it. And then Cornerstone, Lane Dennis is a personal friend of my parents and Ronald and myself. He very kindly let me have David Porter as an editor, who was my next door neighbor, and who more or less just did a small amount of editing, just sort of punctuation and a little bit of tidying up. So it is essentially what came out in the middle of those nights. I'd write maybe 3 nights a week, go to bed about 4 a.m. when the birds started singing. I remember always birds singing, so it must have been spring. And then sleep till morning, work for the day. The next day, work all day. And then I sleep one night, and the following night do it again. So that was the result of that. And it went out into the world, and it could have turned into a full-time career almost right away. It generated a lot of interest. Now, Bobby Scott was one of the first people I heard from back, and Bobby will be able to say when it was and quite where he fits into it as the Americans, because it was published in America to begin with. Kingsway, I believe, it was published once in England, but didn't make a splash here, as it has continued to be in print in America. Now, it was at a moment when people were starting to cast about in America, historically, now, back in that early 80s period, thinking about home education. And so it arrived just as people were thinking it through. I never wrote it for home education. The model I had seen was, first of all, a little school. But secondly, yes, it had been used by thousands of people. The syllabus, the curriculum which came out from the PNEU had been used. And as someone myself who had to study at home because of rheumatic fever as a teenager, and we had already homeschooled, not thinking of it as homeschool, just teaching children at home. It wasn't a movement when I started using that idea as one of the alternatives in education for a child who is dyslexic. But anyway, it arrived in America at a time when people were very interested. So it's had a much bigger effect. And all I can say is that original thought of passing something on, because the books were out of print, I don't think they would have necessarily been found. There's a lot of good books from that era that have disappeared totally.
Yeah.
Why did the PNEU disappear so totally? Well, Elaine Cooper and I have had the privilege since then of starting to meet the people before they died. And Elaine Cooper has made many recordings with these teachers. And that will be an interesting archive, actually, because they were trained when the Charlotte Mason College at Ambleside was going the way she wanted it to. So you had people trained properly, which none of us are, who experienced it themselves when they were usually about 18 years old, to 21. So it was a profound experience for them, and many of them brought up by mothers who themselves had had Charlotte Mason training. Now, before Elaine and started working on this, well, we called it Child Light, didn't we, to, project, and then Child Life. Bobby in America had started inviting me to speak to his teachers from his school. He sent a teacher over to study at LaBrie for a term, who actually went to this little PNU school before it closed, and start to be able to make the bridge between what you could do, say, in a contemporary society on the outskirts of Atlanta, where you have that perimeter road and you don't have the meadows and streams and the little pathways of the Lake District, where Charlotte Mason worked. But of course, the beauty of her system was that it was used in by these worldwide families in very difficult circumstances, in the middle of Africa, in hot places with deserts, with nothing that children could go play outside, too hot, and all sorts of situations. It has its application. If you're interested in a childhood that used that, there's Penelope Lively's book, Oleander. Do you know the one?
I do.
Oleander. It has Oleander in the title, and it's an autobiography of her childhood in Egypt during the Second World War. And her nanny used the PNEU. And, of course, she's a well-known writer now, and it just goes to show the education a person has. But there she is describing these wonderful books that came, and she and her nanny were educated through them. But it can happen anywhere. Well, Bobby invited me to speak to various schools, also homeschooling days, parents, once in a while. And then by this time, Elaine had joined us. I think, Ronald, I had so many letters coming, but I was of course, it was pre-computer days, and I was much too busy, and I would put them in shoeboxes. So then Ranald said, we must start in England, it's called a charity. It's actually a non-profit-making organization. And Elaine Cooper coped with all these letters, didn't you, Elaine?
It was extraordinary reading these letters from mothers and fathers and parents and teachers who just felt there was life in the books. And in for the children's sake, and just wanted to find out more. People were really hungry for something they recognized as being life-giving.
Yes.
And so we started trying to answer what we could of the letters, and enjoyed the contact with Bobby very much in America. And then Eve Anderson became part of.
Yes, and I was going to describe that, because that was you and me.
Yes.
And that was because Bobby was coming over, and he had made the contact with Eve, not us.
Yes.
Now, I forgot one very PNEU thing there. That was Joan Molyneux, who had been the principal and whose sister Elizabeth had died, who really was part of the original stream of people connected with Charlotte Mason. She retired then from the job as principal. That would have been about 1972, I guess. 73, no, it wouldn't. A couple of years later, 74 maybe. Anyway, I could think about the exact date. And when it came time for me to... She used to visit us at LaBrie and talk over things. She loved the manor and the work we were doing. Her one warning was, don't let it get too big. Things get spoilt when it's too big. And I know when Eve came, she also recognized it as a very sort of a similar sort of atmosphere in some ways, but different age of people. Anyway, Joan, we were in contact. And she, when Ranald thought I should write the book, she encouraged me. I went to St. Albans and talked to her about it. And we probably went together, but I can't remember. Certainly I went, where she lived, which is west of London. And then when I wrote the manuscript, This was very important, actually. I sent it to her to see if I was anything I'd got wrong. Mm. I always feel that's very important with this idea of people taking an idea and reading it into their own context. Mm. And the one thing she had me write more about or change was masculine activity. Mm. And I've thought about it since. And it's a rather delicate concept that can easily get misunderstood. Mm. But that was encouraging because she totally, I've got the letter somewhere, felt it was very special. And then, of course, recently, Helen Barber, who died at 102 or something, who was also totally Charlotte Mason trained, that Elaine and I visited, and I had known her previously, she also felt it was spot on, as they say. Mm. So these things encourage me that it's a good representation of the original thought and life. Anyway, Bobby was coming to England, and Elaine had all these letters, so she was the one knowing about it. And she and I went to visit this person he had contact called Eve Anderson outside, well, very near Windsor, outside of London, near Windsor Castle, actually, Windsor Great Park. Anyway, so Elaine and I drove up, and Eve was one of these people who, from the age of five, had herself had nature notebooks and herself had been brought up this way and then had gone on to be fully trained. 1936, I think, she graduated.
A bit later. 52.
A whole range of some wonderful women of her age and older ones. And she was chairman at that time of the Charlotte Mason College Association, I believe, when we first met her. Anyway, as we sat there talking and she heard our enthusiasm, it was wonderful to see, wasn't it, Elaine? Mm. It was as if a mist of time had covered her own interest as she had proceeded through life. She hadn't changed as a person, but she had been headmistress of a successful PNU school that had become well known in Eton, actually. It had started for the children of Eton School, had teachers, masters, and it had kept up with more ordinary, practice. There's two kinds of educations in England. I was stumbling because there's two kinds. There's what in America would be the public schools, the maintained schools, the government schools. That's had its very interesting history and lots of ideas and needs. But then the private schools have a different philosophy still and always have had a different standard. And hers was definitely one of those private schools. But as she talked with us, she became more and more enthusiastic and full of life.
Rediscovering almost what she had been part of.
Absolutely. It was lovely, wasn't it, Elaine?
It was quite extraordinary, yes. And she loved coming, as time went on, her coming to America became part of this new, vibrant life that she really had grown up on.
And she became more and more enthusiastic about it all.
She did.
Even that first day, she rushed off to get her nature notebook, started at 5 years old, that she kept up all her life, painting when she was on holiday, and showing us photographs of taking little children on nature notes. Then Bobby met her. Now, Bobby can fill that bit in. And through that, arranged for her to go to America, which she went to. She paid her way, and she must have given a great deal in America, showing illustrations of how to do nature notes. She told me a funny story. I mean, you must have more. Once she was somewhere and wanted to take the children, some grade of children, on a nature walk and to show them how to do these watercolor paintings for their nature notebooks to do a lesson. And they were going to take her to a botanic garden. It may have been you in Atlanta. And she said, no, we're just going to go outside and find bugs. And I always remember that. I think that's very wonderful. Weeds and bugs. It's what's actually around you. And they found some fascinating things. Mm-hmm. Spiders and all sorts of interesting things outside to bring back.
It sort of, it showed the acceptance of a creation around us wherever we were. Mm. It didn't have to be a special place. to enjoy nature or the world that God had made. It was just around us, wherever we were.
That's right.
And she reflected that in the way she was happy to look at creatures or plants absolutely anywhere.
Yes, and it was typical of all of those people, and actually a whole section of the English population, but a great love and enthusiasm. Well, this was rekindled and became her joy. We sadly had her die young, relatively young, probably about 75, from cancer, which was a sad loss. She loved coming to America, and she loved the enthusiasm of you Americans and the fact you do things, which in England everybody waits two generations before they budge, typically. But she also loved the conference which Elaine organized at Ambleside. How many years ago was it?
1999.
So that's a long time ago-ish. It's not nearly all that long ago.
Nearly 10 years ago.
And by this time, Elaine and I had been invited to be members of the Charlotte Mason College Association, a huge honor because we're practically the only people who didn't train. I'm going to be 70 next year in the spring of 2011, and my age is the last year that had Charlotte Mason training. So I would have, if I'd chosen that, known about it, I would fall just within it. So the group of people right on the executive committee are just about my age now. But through that, and through Eve invited me up to Ambleside for one of their annual reunions, or they were biannual, I suppose. It was residential at the college, to speak on Charlotte Mason and the book I'd written, and it caused a great stir. And that's when John Thornton heard about me.
John
Thornley. And then he reorganized the archive at at the library there, the Charlotte Mason. So one thing led to another. And this younger generation, so to speak, younger than Eve, younger than some of those wonderful people that you and Eve went to record, Elaine. About, and those are, you know, I'd love to hear some of those again. Because yes, it embodies a variety of experiences and types of people and the use they made of the material they received. And some of them have lived through hardships. And to a woman, they have been all shining examples of living life, carrying on, enjoying, and bearing the fruit of these ideas, not just as subjects, whether it was Eve climbing the mountains, pushing up Heidi, whoever her name was, the Swiss. About 80
Heidi.
Years old. Heidi.
Heidi. Yes.
And being faithful friends to each other still in their older age. Faithful friends, so a real community that's ongoing. That's another striking feature. What else would you think of, Elaine? That has gone on. Of course, it's spawned off to other groups of Charlotte Mason people, homeschooling. I now meet people, even in their late 20s, who've been brought up and whose lives were changed because they either were homeschooled at some point and their mothers used this, or they went to a little school. And it is very lovely to see. And it's not the half of it, of course.
Yes, well, Sue, that's really lovely. And I think what all that you have said and modestly have described your role in it all is that you definitely have passed the torch on. And I think being the bridge between the very deep hope of Charlotte Mason that she just wouldn't be remembered as an educator through her books, but that the legacy of what she understood to be a gift to her of seeing children as persons, of understanding knowledge as being a really important part of a life which we all have to take seriously. And that the contribution she made towards schooling for children in a Christ-like way, her hope was that it would be her lasting legacy. And I think that
We can just be very glad that you passed the torch on to us, and quite clearly it is flaming and doing well. And as we look to the future, we just need to remember the things you've mentioned, the quiet modesty, humility, the humor, the not trying to do, not trying to take over the world, so to speak, but yes, just to really be faithful in the situations in which these particular teachers or ourselves today find ourselves, the element of faithfulness to this legacy. So thank you very much indeed, Sue. That's been wonderful.
There's always more because, I mean, Elaine and I then went on. I wrote a book for the family's sake because I realized it doesn't stop there. And it was very much what Charlotte Mason did, because I don't know if you know, she started out, was instrumental, this way of thinking, of starting something called the Mother's Union in the Anglican Church. And you mustn't forget her very strong Christian, I mean, I use the word infrastructure, but background, the rock, and her aim, which was to bring children in relationship to the Lord and to be subject. Elaine was just talking to me about how Jesus spoke about obedience and these habits of forming the habits of obeying in little ways. Then a person is ready as an adult to sacrificially obey God's laws. That, I think, is terribly important in this day. We have to think again, what stands out? And one thing that stands out is, where is authority? Where is our authority? And what rules our life? And what is important? So I think, too, the follow-on, the other book, which isn't as well known, but for the family's sake, has elements in it. There's bits that could be shortened and bullet points so busy people could read it faster, which is rather important. But this lies behind it too, the culture of a family or a community or a church, and not just one institution, such as a school. And these are ideas which we meet, different authors, different people who have always long to bring up children in the right way, I think. And there's some pernicious, especially poisonous ideas out right now, and ways of treating each other as persons, or not as persons. So it's never been more important to find out. The last thing I'd say is, none of us can be too perfect about it. I mean, I can just say perfect. My marriage isn't all that perfect. I wasn't all that perfect as a mother. You know, that's... And I look back like other people nearly 70 do, and you wish you had done something differently at different points in your life. I mean, it's just reality, isn't it? And we just do the best we can at the time. But it helps to have some clear ideas of what those important things would be and try to aim for them. And it really does help to have a philosophy and to see the elements, doesn't it, Elaine?
Oh, absolutely. Well, it's been lovely. I hope that this recording will have brought a little taste of visiting with Susan herself to you all. And thank you very much for listening.